You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Today we have three contributors to the new book, Queer Twin Cities. As you know, The Advocate just named Minneapolis the gayest city in the U.S. The Twin Cities is home to one of the largest and most vital GLBT populations in the nation. Drawn from the pioneering work of the Twin Cities GLBT Oral History Project, a collective organization of students, scholars, and activists devoted to documenting and interpreting the lives of GLBT people in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Queer Twin Cities is a uniquely critical collection of essays on Minnesota's vibrant queer communities, past and present. Engaging and revelatory, Queer Twin Cities offers a critical analysis of local history and community and fills a glaring omission in the culture and history of Minnesota, looking not only to a remarkable past, but to a vibrant future. We're pleased to welcome three contributors. We have Professor Jennifer Pierce, who is at the University in American Studies, and she's former director of the Center for Advanced Feminist Studies at the university. We also have Kevin Murphy, associate professor of history, and Alex Urquhart as a PhD candidate in American Studies. They'll be reading to you and then be happy to take your questions. Please welcome our Queer Twin Cities readers today. Thank you.
Well, first, thank you so much, Terry, for having us. And I'd also like to thank our editor, who's sitting in the very first row, Todd Orhala from University of Minnesota Press, and Daniel Kasprzak, who not only works at the press, but was one of my undergraduates many years ago. I want to begin by talking about the film Milk, which I'm sure many of you have seen, which chronicles the life of Harvey Milk. And it was the first Hollywood portrayal of a gay political movement. Now, this film provoked very mixed reactions from activists, scholars, and GLBT folks. Some celebrated the wide exposure of Harvey Milk's story, and others criticized its historical accuracy. In Minnesota, the debate focused on two scenes involving a gay Minnesota teen. In the first scene, Harvey Milk advises this desperate and suicidal young man to get out of town and take the first bus to San Francisco. This scene is structured so that that viewers will identify with the hope of Harvey Milk's movement and empathize with the desperation of teens, gay teens trapped in the Midwest. This empathy and identification comes full circle when later in the film, the audience meets the, quote, liberated Minnesotan who is now working in Los Angeles as a gay activist. The notion that San Francisco and LA have functioned as cities as gay salvation, while the Midwest is the place of gay suicidal despair, should sit uneasily with a Minnesota audience. The Twin Cities, after all, has a history of gay radical activism as long and deep as those found in the coastal cities. The film's use of the boy from Minnesota to position cities like San Francisco as cosmopolitan sites of salvation in a national geography marked by intolerance and fear continues to circulate in our own time. This particular story obscures the rich tradition of queer organizing and sociality in the Midwest. Further, it assumes that Minnesota's history has followed a repressive, gendered, and sexual trajectory in contrast to San Francisco's seemingly more dynamic and liberatory history. In claiming the Twin Cities as queer, our book provides an alternative account that challenges these assumptions in two important ways. First, we show that Minnesota has its own active and vibrant movement of LGBT people who fought for rights and created a political movement that was both connected to and unique from those on the coast. Second, we examine how sexuality, particularly in its transgressive expressions, shaped people's lives in Minnesota from the late 19th century to the present. By sexuality, we refer to a range of identities, straight, queer, lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual, among others. And we also refer to a range of meanings, desires, norms, and relationships that operate within hierarchies of power across time and place. rather than treating identities or communities as singular, as in the gay community, our book illuminates how sexual politics have shaped and organized social relationships in differing and contradictory ways over time and place. What this means is that queer desire, love, and sex are only some of the forms of sexuality that we consider. To take one interesting example that my colleague Alex Urquhart will talk about in more detail, in the late 19th century, health officials and moral reformers attempted to regulate the sexuality of immigrant lumberjacks by discouraging their forays into Minneapolis to visit prostitutes. According to one historical account, quote, "free from booze, professional gamblers, and prostitutes, protected from all the parasites and dangers of the outside world, the camps were in every sense a true home to these displaced men." Paradoxically, the very logging camps reformers imagined would protect men from the dangers of sex in the city were also spaces where men transgressed the bounds of respectable gender and sexual expression. Within these all-male environments, some men dressed as women, presumably to please themselves or to attract other men, and others lived together as couples. While the existing historical evidence is certainly suggestive, we do not know definitively whether these men had sex with one another. Nevertheless, their relationships and interactions constitute social relations that clearly depart from dominant gender and sexual norms of the time period. Our focus on sexuality as an organizing principle allows us to capture the complex workings of male homosociality in an industry that was crucial to the economic development of Minnesota. Theorizing sexuality as a principle of social organization also illuminates how sexual identities create and give meaning to other identities. As Brandon Lacey Campos, one of the panelists involved in a roundtable in our book, points out, sexuality often has different meanings and salience in communities of color than among white gay men. For instance, in Latino communities, men may have sex with other men, but many are unlikely to adopt a gay identity or to consider themselves part of the broader LGBT community. These examples demonstrate not only that the category LGBT has different meanings to different groups of people, but that sexuality also produces meanings as it intersects with other identities. In this light, sexuality represents a central part of LGBT community history, but also of Latino history, American Indian history, women's history, and many other domains we might assume are distinct from or unrelated to sexual past. Theorizing sexuality as a principle of social organization also enables us to see how sexuality structures relationships. At the level of meaning, terms such as prostitute, welfare queen, teen mother, and AIDS risk invoked imagined relationships between morally good and morally bad subjects, such as good girls versus sluts, working families versus tangles of pathology, or domestic partner versus pedophile. At the same time, these sexual terms have animated and transformed national debates that have had far-reaching social and economic consequences for immigrants, poor people, men of color, and the inner city. Battles over who engages in the right types of public and private sex have not only structured the formation and marginalization of LGBT communities, but they have also fueled initiatives to close borders and welfare, criminalize and incarcerate an entire generation of young men of color, and transfer wealth from rural and urban areas to racially segregated suburbs. Understanding the ways that sexuality and LGBT community politics are interwoven with these broader dynamics is one of the purposes of this book. Finally, imagining sexuality as an organizing principle across time and place means the stories we tell are always changing. As mentioned earlier, lumberjacks who cross-dressed and lived as couples experienced a degree of tolerance in logging camps at the turn of the 20th century. In the 1950s, bars catering to, quote, sex deviates, end quote, this is the term for homosexuals in this historical moment, were tolerated by the police in Minneapolis, but not if their patrons chose to cross-dress in these spaces. By the 1960s, however, gender nonconformity had become a psychiatric diagnosis called gender identity disorder. Transgender people had to submit to this diagnosis and edit their sexual desires and histories of gender performance accordingly if they were to obtain authorization by the medical establishment for reassignment surgery. As these historical examples suggest, meanings and assumptions about sexuality and gender changed dramatically over the 20th century, but not in a neat line from oppression to liberation that we might imagine. Excuse me. Our interest in how sexuality is constructed as an organizing principle in the Twin Cities grows out of a collective project whose origins can be traced to a pair of 2003 research proposals developed by two graduate students, Jason Ruiz and Duarte Trofton, and two professors, Kevin Murphy and Roderick Ferguson, to conduct oral histories with individuals who identified as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. These projects were motivated by the paucity of oral histories focusing on queer life in the region and the desire to produce a community resource that could be made available to researchers, activists, and other people interested in the history of queer life in the Upper Midwest. This project grew into the Twin Cities Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Oral History Project, a collective of faculty, grad students, and community researchers dedicated to collecting and preserving the life histories of those who formed queer identities in the metropolitan area of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Since the project began in 2003, we've collected nearly 100 life stories, which are to be housed eventually in the Treader Collection in GLBT Studies at Elmer Anderson Library on this campus. We purposefully designed our method to seek a diversity of people. By diversity, we mean not only race, gender, and particular queer identities, but also modes of public life. Activists and business owners have told us their stories, but so too have individuals who are not political leaders, not political figures, or entrepreneurs. Several of our life history narrators live in Minneapolis's most radical neighborhoods, but have lived queerness in a largely domestic private matter. Many self-identified as gay or lesbian in their teens or younger adults, while others came out in their 60s. In fact, we talked to 60-year-olds who had, one 60-year-old who had never engaged in same-sex activity, but nevertheless strongly identified as gay. We also talked to 70-year-olds who had engaged in same-sex activity for decades, but were reluctant to claim identity categories that one might attach to such behavior. Other people we interviewed have lived their entire lives in the Twin Cities, and still others grew up here, traveled widely, and then came back. Over time, participants expanded the range of methods so that we used not only oral histories, but we also used archival material from Minnesota Historical Society, the Treader Collection here on campus, and a number of people also did field work. I think the book's chapters demonstrate this breadth. They draw not only from collected life histories, but many other sources. They also take different forms and draw from different disciplines, including history, sociology, geography, as well as interdisciplinary fields such as feminist studies and American studies. Excuse me. Thematically, they all explode. Yes, they all explode. They explore a number of questions about sexuality as a form of social organization. Some address the dilemma of using sexual identity as a basis for community. Others focus on how sexuality and gender have been used to police the boundaries of space and place. Still others examine how sexuality is intertwined within the broader context of political economy and national politics. All we believe offers something important, both theoretically and empirically, and together they enhance and enrich not just local and regional queer archives, but understandings of sexuality, queer sex, and socio-spatial relations more broadly. That's my introduction to the volume, and what I'm going to do now is turn things over to Alex Urquhart, who's going to read from a chapter he wrote for the book, followed by Kevin Murphy, who will read from a chapter from his book. So, Alex.
Okay, so I guess I've never really read this part of the chapter, but it seems to be the part that everyone loves. A number of reviewers have kind of grabbed onto it. It channels the kind of Monty Python, I'm a lumberjack, and that's okay. But it comes from really the beginning of when we were asked to kind of write a narrative history of the Twin Cities. So I went to the archive, and I wasn't finding anything. So I was looking under things like police reports and sodomy convictions, and I couldn't really find anything. And then I stumbled upon this. So this is kind of the story of cross-dressing lumberjacks that I will read you now. Until clear-cutting exhausted white pine forests at the end of the 1920s, demand to cut, process, and transport timber brought thousands of lumbermen from Canada and the northeastern United States to Minnesota. At the industry's apex in 1900, 1 year's culling of Minnesota white pine could have built nearly 600,000 two-story homes or a boardwalk 9 feet wide and encircling the world at the equator. During the period, 20,000 men worked in temporary tar paper logging camps across northern Minnesota, while thousands of others staffed attendant industries. Logging shacks slapped together on jagged hillsides carved out of the forest epitomized the Minnesota wilderness, yet underscored the absence of stable working families in these industries. Long hours on the job, constant demands to pack up and move toward remaining stands of white pine, and extremely harsh Minnesota winters meant that women and children rarely accompanied loggers during the weeks and months that they worked. Work in the timber industry offered little chance for marriage, a fixed household, child-rearing, and gender-segregated domestic labor that defined 19th-century bourgeois society. Middle-class women's prescribed roles as childbearer, domestic worker, and moral leader for the family were structurally impossible in this booming industry. The bulk of these workers' contact with women occurred not in the refuge of the home and family, spaces that in the lumber camp context were entirely homosocial, but on their days off in towns and cities, and often in the context of alcohol and prostitution. Given these social and sexual patterns, political, economic, and cultural institutions embrace the homosocial structure of the lumber camp as a place where working men were made into productive citizens, a conclusion that generated new definitions of family and domestic relations. Although the camps did not produce a male-headed household supplemented by female domestic work and child-rearing, they required the same types of labor and social stewardship normally performed by women. While this included cooking and cleaning, the camps also needed to reproduce the moralizing influences of the wife and family, values that helped ensure productivity and order. To accomplish such regulation, lumber companies reorganized working men's time around working, eating, sleeping, and even religious observances to discourage the entertainments commonly associated with such industries, drinking, gambling, and visiting prostitutes. Preachers known as sky pilots, for example, would travel between camps offering moral education to the men, often extolling close male bonds and condemning the corrupting influences of women. Although corporate, civic, and religious leaders worked to chasten lumbermen's lives and desires, a number of sexual and gender transgressions became possible in these industries. An industry inspector reported one such instance when asked about the presence of women in the camps. In his tenure moving from camp to camp in the early part of the 20th century, the agent remembered that female labor was almost non-existent, even taboo. In one instance, he was surprised when he found a camp that had a female cook. The inspector's initial shock over the unexpected appearance of a woman subsided when he finally realized the cook was actually a man who dressed as a woman. The camp inspector remembered, quote, "After supper that night, the cook came into the office, dressed up in women's clothing with lipstick on, face painted and powdered and wearing rings. He visited a short while with Dale and myself. Dale told me later that the cook stayed all winter and turned out very fine meals." The same official also documented a cook whose gender he could never establish. Quote, "There was another cook at the horse camp of the Virginia Rainy Lake Company east of Cusson who dressed as a man while cooking. But when the man met him in town, he was dressed like a woman, and they never did know if he was a man or a woman." This account raises a number of intriguing questions. Was this a man who was having sex with other men in town? Was this a woman who passed as a man and was able to benefit from the relatively substantial wages that being a lumber camp cook provided, and doubly profited from the attendant sexual industries of the camp town? After all, as cooks were among the highest paid camp residents, and as timber industry as a whole paid better wages than many industries, working men could often afford sexual pleasures for sale while away from camp. Regardless of who this person was, because he, she could be inserted into the narrative of the homosocial family of the lumber industry, this person was able to violate a number of bourgeois ideas about gender and family. So this is picture time. So there's also a great picture. There was also a practice of having cross-dressing parties at the turn of the century. So it's a wonderful picture of a party in the in Minneapolis where all the men are dressed as women and the women are dressed as men. Although inspectors' reports never explicitly confronted the topic of homosexuality, the stories told about lumberjacks convey a distinct sense of love and companionship between workers. And while the visits to brothels were a regular occurrence, this was, quote, kind of a no-no for the lumber family social order. The narrative of lumberjack culture and productivity required that companionship, whether sexual or not, be found with other men. A laborer's, quote, only companion and confidant can ever be another oversized, tobacco-chewing, bean-farting, fanny-kicking lumberjack, unquote. These male companions, however, were sometimes given sexualized nicknames, like broad-assed Oli, and names similar to the explicit sexual titles for madams in the town, like Pretty Peggy or Big Tit Tilly. It was even a common practice in the industry's later years for young single men to live in small shacks with an older male peer who served as advisor. Lumberjacks' lives complement orthodox understandings of relationships between work and leisure, between productive and destructive endeavors, between normalcy and deviance, and between homosexuality and all of these binaries. In this regime of sexuality, one could have sex with a man, live with a man, even have a lifelong male companion, and not necessarily have it called into question. This is perhaps one reason why historical accounts of sexual acts are hard to find. The signs that men were developing intimate bonds, passing friendships, sharing rooms, living together, and even having sex with one another were normalized by the demands of the industry. During an era, so this is a second little vignette, which I hope you enjoy. During an era when manual labor enabled homosocial bonds and corresponding gender and sexual transgression, explicit narratives of homosexual sex generated undeniable controversy. But in perhaps the most widely publicized example of male homosexuality from the early 20th century in the Twin Cities, when an itinerant worker murdered his male lover and that lover's mother, alcoholism, not homosexuality, bore the brunt of the blame for the deadly scenario. In 1906, William Williams, an attractive 20-year-old steam fitter, murdered 16-year-old John Keller and the boy's mother in St. Paul. Williams insisted that he accidentally shot the two after an argument over moving to Winnipeg with Keller, a move the boy's mother opposed. The two men had been sleeping together in Keller's bed at his family's residence at the time of the murder, an apparently common occurrence over the course of their two-year relationship. Although the prosecution highlighted William and Keller's intimacy, there was little discussion or scandal about the sex between the two men. In the course of the trial, the prosecutor attempted to introduce the impropriety of their relationship first when questioning the origins of the conflict between William's and Keller's mother. "Is it not a fact that you left because they insisted on John sleeping in another room?" asked the prosecutor. "No, that is a lie," shouted Williams in a fury of anger. The second attempt by the prosecutor to make homosexuality the issue on trial was in a discussion of the origin of their relationship. William and Keller met when they began working together at a fort in Montana. Williams told the court that he and Keller left to escape squalid living conditions that forced them to live in a tiny little shed. The prosecution retorted that discomfort over their intimacy generated the pair's departure from the camp. These instances were the extent of the public record about William's sexuality as a source of outrage or shame. The prosecutor's frustration over failing to paint William's pink stems from his attempt to do so in a context where homosociality was fairly normalized. After all, extraction industries required men to live together intergenerationally and in close quarters for extended periods of time. The prosecution was able to evoke the discomfort that surrounded these practices, but failed to make male intimate relations the operative category of deviance or a secret whose exposure would guarantee a conviction. Twin Cities daily papers, for example, regularly reported that Keller and Williams' relationships had been intimate for 2 years. Furthermore, despite the fact that their sex lives appeared in the public record, neither Williams nor his lover were ever charged with sodomy, a sexual practice that was criminalized in Minnesota 15 years earlier. In fact, the anti-sodomy statute was rarely, if ever, enforced. To enforce sodomy laws would have required the state of Minnesota to draw attention to the practices and lifestyles, whether sexual or not, of the tens of thousands of men who were living and working together throughout the state. Policing sodomy would not only make homosexuality deviant, it would inscribe deviance onto the homosocial relationships that industries required as they harvested Minnesota's natural resources. While the prosecutor attempted and failed to make homosexuality the main motivation in the killing, the defense succeeded at casting alcohol in that role. Expert witness testimony from doctors verified alcohol abuse by both Williams and Keller's mother, placing an alleged mental disorder on center stage. The disorder in question was not homosexuality, the nascent socioscientific category of same-sex sexual deviance, but alcoholic mania. In the end, the jury found Williams guilty of two counts of second-degree murder, a capital crime. Although the jury eventually handed down a death sentence, it extensively deliberated before reaching a verdict and struggled with the validity of Williams' defense, even asking the judge for clarification on the aggregation of murder charges while pondering a diminished sentence. The Williams case was never widely rendered a story of a gay murderer. There is no homosexual panic or community outrage documented in the historical record. Williams' hanging continues to be a site of scrutiny and intrigue, not because it memorializes a turn-of-the-century same-sex love affair gone wrong, but because it was the last execution performed in Minnesota and a catalyst for the abolition of the death penalty. Williams' executioners miscalculated the stretching properties of the rope used in the hanging, a mistake that allowed Williams' neck to withstand the fall from the platform, and which meant that he would remain alive for nearly 15 minutes as he hung in agony from the gallows. Three deputies were forced to hold the rope taut to guarantee Williams' suffocation. The, quote, public outcry against the botched hanging was severe, unquote, challenging any assumptions that accusations of homosexuality surrounded the case yielded public vengeance and a desire for suffering and bloodlust. The violence of the execution only added to sympathy Williams acquired just moments earlier when, according to one published report, he gave, quote, a dignified speech in which he proclaimed his innocence. He said the murdered boy was the best friend he had ever had, unquote. I'm going to turn it over to you.
So I'll be jumping ahead to the relatively recent past, the past four decades or so. Today, I'm reading from the conclusion I contributed to Queer Twin Cities. It's entitled, Gay Was Good, Progress, Homonormativity, and Oral History. This chapter, and I'd argue the volume as a whole, counters two related assumptions about LGBT politics and history. The first is that the history of LGBT people over the past several decades is entirely one of progress. That queer people have gone from a state of oppression, secrecy, and invisibility in the period before the modern gay rights movement to one of increasing acceptance and openness. The second related assumption is that we know things have gotten better because LGBT people, and especially gay men and lesbians, have become more normal and assimilated. They're winning the right to marry like straight people, to raise children, to serve in the military, they've been represented in Hollywood productions, and are courted by big corporate advertisers. Yet the research we conducted for this project, and especially the oral histories we collected, complicate and even challenge these assumptions. I argue in the chapter that for many LGBT people in the Twin Cities, some things have gotten worse over time, that assimilation has major costs, and that the goal of becoming normal often reflects a narrowed vision of social and political change. So one of the ways in which the evidence we collected for this volume challenges the kinds of assumptions about a kind of progressive history, queer history over the past several decades is that it counters the notion that there is this sort of pivotal moment, the Stonewall riots of June 1969 as sort of shaping a modern gay movement and as sort of moving things very quickly toward a state of enlightenment and progress. In fact, many of the people that we interviewed have no recollection of hearing about the Stonewall riots in 1969. Some people said Yeah, we were too busy going out to places like Sutton's and the Gay 90s. That's not something I remember as really altering my life very much. And even some of the narrators who were politically aware and active in the period downplayed the importance of Stonewall, citing a local activist organization called FREE, a university-based group founded in April 1969, 2 months before Stonewall. Interestingly, FREE organized not strictly around discrete sexual identities, but around a broader challenge to regimes of sexual normativity. The acronym stands for Fight Repression of Erotic Expression. Although FREE's founders, Corrine Phelps and Stephen Ehrig, formed the group to fight for what they called homosexual emancipation, they linked the oppression of homosexuals to broader structures of inequity and aligned the group with the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the women's movement. Similar to the more famous Gay Liberation Front, which was established in New York City months later, FREE members advocated a gay power revolution aimed at celebrating and legitimating difference rather than advocating assimilation. The main difference between a gay person and a hip gay person is self-acceptance, said Ehrig in a student newspaper interview. He continued, a hip gay person is not ashamed of what he is. In another interview, he asserted, one of our main functions as a group is to acclimate the straight public to our existence, to accept our reality. This early radical movement, which also emphasized the economic causes and effects of anti-gay sentiment, established a local framework for understanding gay liberation that extended beyond a moderate claim to belonging. Even more interesting, many narrators, while recognizing positive changes with the gay and lesbian movement of the 1970s, resisted a characterization of the preceding period as repressive. For example, like many of those we interviewed, Linda, a 60-year-old white gay lesbian, white lesbian, looked back with nostalgic longing on the 1950s and 1960s. Quote, well, I think it's unfair to just say that was a repressive time. I mean, I lived in that time, and I know it was warm and sweet and tender time at times, end quote. Others spoke of some perceived losses that attended the post-Stonewall period. Tom, a 59-year-old white gay man, referred to some of the costs of gay visibility and the negative consequences of a politics of coming out. When you're known and you're out, you can also be an easier target for people's homophobia. Whereas in years gone by, when people were closeted, maybe they could sneak through without getting that homophobic reaction. I mean, look at all those born-again Christians that are much more hostile to homosexuals than maybe they ever would have been in the past. Don't you think that's a part of what we're dealing with now? Judy, a 59-year-old lesbian, spoke about positive changes that emerged from identifying as a lesbian and as a feminist, but also ruminated with some ambivalence about the consequences of gay liberation and women's movements. When asked about the challenges for younger generations today, she responded, well, I think there are many. Many more choices, and life is consequently much more difficult because there are more choices to make. I followed a path that I thought I didn't have any choice about, and so I didn't agonize about whether I have kids or not. They happened to me, and then I took care of them, and I loved them. So it's a blessing and a curse to be 19 now. More choices and more choices to make. This ambivalence about the past was even more pronounced in testimony that dealt with changes in queer politics and culture over the past several decades. Some interviewees spoke of a decline in community feeling and politics. Judy, for example, answered a question about changes in the lesbian community over the previous 25 years as follows. I don't know that there really is much of a community anymore. I think people are scattered and integrated more. The whole idea, we were very downwardly mobile at the time. It was not okay to be middle class or above. You were to be working class. You were not to be making a lot of money. That has changed dramatically. People are allowed to make a lot of money today. It's valued. People are well regarded if they raise children, if they stay together. This is all different. People are home. and family is important where before it was dancing and drinking and politics. Political action. There isn't a lot of political action now. For Judy, the stakes of losing a coherent community politics are high. Quote, "It'll be too bad if we let our community splinter. You know, if it happens that our freedom starts being taken from us, we're not going to have a way to fight that. And it could happen. It's happened before." End quote. Judy was not the only narrator who tied a process of integration to a loss of community or to assert the serious dangers of such a loss. Tom, for example, identifies a politics of assimilation as part of a broader and alarming conservative embrace of security that works against the liberatory and communal goals of queer life and politics on the left in the 1970s. So, I mean, it really was a time that just seems like a far-off land or another culture. You know, people there were living in communes. I think a lot of people at that time thought of themselves as bisexual because they were experimenting with sex, with men, and with women. You know, maybe orgies or communes where groups of people would have sex. And in some ways, it seems like now that we're in the land of George Bush, it seems in a way almost horrifying how much people are oriented towards security and towards what I feel are latching onto value systems that are not really going to save us. They're actually going to destroy us, all out of a need for security. End quote. For her part, Claire identifies commercialization and corporatism as twin engines of decline, as evidenced by her comparison of recent Twin Cities Pride events with those that took place decades earlier. She said, "Of course, now Twin Cities Pride is just a mega event. I think much too orchestrated and much too commercial, in my opinion. In the early 70s, there still was a sense of this kind of special, secret community. And there was something about that secrecy that was actually kind of appealing because it was like a family in a kind of way. And the other interesting thing is that you were thrown in with people of different socioeconomic groups than yourself, people with different interests than yourself, different professional areas, different races, in a way that you might not have been elsewhere." End quote. Claire was not alone in recalling the excitement of secrecy and of claiming an outsider status. In a 2004 newspaper interview about early Pride events, for example, gay activist Greg White recalled, quote, "Back then, being out was scandalous and exciting, and walking into a gay club was almost revolutionary," end quote. Thanks.
People have questions, or happy to entertain questions about the project, about what we talked about.
I'll do it.
Thank you.
Finally, I'm here. Like, I read part of this book manuscript in a public history class, and then I read entire manuscript in Kevin Murphy's class, and then like I went to the Nomad, and then I'm here. So, if I remember correctly, like one of my complaints when I wrote my response paper to Kevin's class. I want to hear more about younger generation, and then because something might be changed, and then Kevin addressed from the Judaist narrative there's a hint of younger generation story, but for my own project I'm planning for IRB, and then I realized that there's just something about institutional structure which prevent hard to hear younger generation voice. So, was it the case? Could you explain more about the?
Yeah, I guess we designed the project at first to talk to people who were part of a kind of older generation. In fact, the term that was used at first by the people who proposed the project was to get the view of elders. And they define elders at first as people 50 or older.
Which oh, dear God.
I know, exactly, right. Yeah, so we sort of forced them to change that terminology. But the idea was that you would, because it was a kind of history project, an oral history project, that you would get the perspectives and the reminiscences of that population. At various times, we attempted to put those, many of the people who collected those oral histories were much younger, and one of the things that we ended the life interviews with were questions about what do you think about the sort of younger generation today, and what kinds of advice would you give? And I think in my section that I read, and especially in the longer chapter, a lot of these reminiscences, a lot of this ambivalence about the past and about what's happened more recently came out of that question. Any other points about that?
Yeah, and I would just add that, part of it too is wanting people who had lived here long enough that they could reflect back and tell. So someone who was 18 or 20 just hadn't been here long enough and to tell a history of the Twin Cities. So we did want to interview people who were 15 and older, but as someone who's 52, I also expect to turn elder. But it was difficult to do, and I actually think Danielle worked as one of our research assistants at one point, and I know she told me she went to the Pride Festival, and we're very constrained by how IRB will let you, the Institutional Review Board will let you approach people. So like we could hand out flyers, but then people were supposed to contact us. We couldn't just go up and say, hi, you want to be interviewed. But I remember her telling me that that she felt a little embarrassed because we were asking for people 50 and older, and she didn't want to offend anybody by saying, do you want to be interviewed? And they're looking at this way, you think I'm 50? So there was that piece of it. But I do think it is harder, particularly if you want to interview people who are minors. The Institutional Review Board really makes it difficult to interview younger people, and I am very interested in what younger people think, and it's why I love to teach, because I always find out in my classrooms, but I do think that would be an interesting addition to this project.
I would like to ask you something concerning the dilemma that that the progresses of the LGBT movement somehow also normalized. I'm myself from Austria, and for me, Minneapolis seems to be a queer paradise compared to Austria. But even in Vienna, we have a similar development, and I can remember the first rainbow parade in Vienna. It was in the mid-90s, and there all people felt still very revolutionary and very political. And 15 years later, many people who attended with us the first parade don't go anymore because they think it's commercialized and bourgeois. So it's a similar thing than what you told here. But do you think, but somehow I don't have an idea how to escape that. So did the people you made interviews with have any ideas how to escape the problem, how to deal with the problem, because somehow it's logic that the progresses are normalizing the situation.
I can start, and I'd also be interested to hear what you have to say. I think people were really ambivalent about it. So I don't think we interviewed anyone who said things have only gotten sort of more conventional or normalizing, and they're worse because of that. People accepted that part of that process has made positive changes in their own lives and in the politics of the present. Nobody was arguing that, you should reinstate anti-sodomy statutes or any of that. But I think the extent to which they were ambivalent was pretty profound. And I think many of them, and I think I share this critique, asked the question, why has a story about things getting better, why has it gotten grafted onto very particular causes in the present? And that is, same-sex marriage, which if you read the kind of mainstream reporting, it's oftentimes presented as the culmination of the entire fight for gay rights, not just since Stonewall, but even the preceding period. So marriage is what will finally give us equality. And people said, why is that? Why is marriage the what happens when marriage is legal? Well,
provision flows through sort of, you know, couples, right? Married couples. Is that really what we're fought for? What others have fought for in the past? Military, right? Like, ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Is that a culmination of what we fought for? Now, you know, one of the things I think I wrote about in this chapter is that organization FREE, which is a fascinating local organization, they were a peace movement, an anti-war movement, and they tied the end of sexual repression to the end of militarism. They would not have seen the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell as a combination of the fight, right? So it was the way in which a progress story is grafted onto what people saw, and I think what I see, and I think our collective saw, as a very narrow view of a kind of queer future that was objectionable.
I guess what I would add to that is I think what the book does, and there's a number of examples of this, is it demands kind of accounting for progress. Like, not just kind of assume that it's progress, right? But what is a progressive narrative? So, like, an example that we talk about in the chapter is, so in the late 80s, there was a political kind of horse trade on the table. One was about public sex, and one was about getting rid of the sodomy statutes. So the kind of deal on the table was, we'll get rid of the sodomy statutes, but we'll make public sex a felony, right? So, like, is that progress or not, right? So we talk about how during that time period, the sodomy law hadn't been enforced in 8 years, right? So there was no one kind of arrested for sodomy. It's hard to prove, like, to get direct evidence to sodomy. However, there were 1,500 convictions for public sex in the course of that 5 years, right? So is that progress, right? Like, what does one allow, right? Public sex, like, isn't normalizing, right? Like, it isn't kind of a, you know, good family narrative, right? In the way that, like, getting rid of sodomy statutes, allowing for kind of good couples to exist, right, is normalizing, but is that progress, right? It's obviously normalizing, but is it progress? Like, is it progress to make 1,500 gay people felons all of a sudden, right? So I think that kind of accounting for what is progress is kind of what we focus on in the book. And there's a number of examples, chapter 8, 9, 10, like, that's really the heart of those chapters.
And just to go along with that, I think this question of progress, because I think that's so much the story that's told about queer people, about feminism, about race, that things are better. There, you know, we have less racism, we have less homophobia, we have, Hollywood stars, we have terrible movies like, The Kids Are All Right, to celebrate lesbians in Hollywood. But I think there is this sort of notion that people grab onto these progress narratives, and I always want to say progress for whom? Because I think when you think about it, and especially when you think about Hollywood and television, it's always for white people. So it's queer white people, and not just white people, middle class to upper middle class white people. I mean, it's no surprise that the first big lesbian Hollywood film is about very upper middle class lesbians who have quite a lifestyle, beautiful house, beautiful kids, all this stuff. And that's not the lives of most queer people in the United States. And then in terms of your question about activism and what now, I mean, a lot of former undergraduates I've worked with who are very interested in queer activism are doing a lot of important work now about queer youth. Queer youth still have the highest suicide rate in the country. They still tend to are much more likely to be homeless, to be in poverty, to be on drugs, because of alienation from their families or their communities of origin. And so I see a lot of young people now doing activism around that. So I don't think the activism is gone. I think it's still there. But I think it's interesting because one of the students I used to work with who now works for a local group who does nothing but work with queer youth, it's never on the news. But Don't Ask, Don't Tell and marriage rights are always on the news. And it seems to me that the problems queer youth are having are far more troubling and far more serious than whether or not I can get married.
And I mean, speaking of the sort of queer youth issue, I think the power of the progressive narrative, both in terms of communal politics, but also in terms of one's life story, is evidenced by this campaign around it gets better, right? The presumption is that things will tend toward the better over time. And lots of people are actually contesting that assertion in that campaign that you actually have to do something to make things better, right?
Yeah.
And indeed, things get worse for a lot of different people as they get older, not necessarily better.
Other questions? Yes.
I apologize. This is my first exposure to the book, so I haven't read it. So question may be answered in there. But I'm curious how you addressed the society's response to AIDS and how that influenced gay rights in Minnesota. I spent the 80s and 90s in Europe, where the response to AIDS was very, very different. I would argue much more humane and natural than it was in the United States at large. However, from what I've heard of the history of the response here in Minnesota, there was really a great response to, you know, a very active response to helping people with HIV. It's also, I think, really fascinating to see how so much suffering somehow bought us a great deal of acceptance in society at large.
Two of the chapters that Alex has written in the book deal precisely with that, yeah.
Well, I guess there are two chapters in the book. One would be the end of what I originally read from, kind of a narrative history.
Mm-hmm.
And that also kind of goes to the narrative of progress. So you're right, the state of Minnesota adopted a number of policies that they were the first to do. Named contact tracing. They had a very good and solid response to HIV very early, largely because Michael Osterholm, who's now the director of CBUS here, was a very kind of pragmatic public health official.
I believe you guys had the first AIDS service organizations in the country, even before New York and
MAP,
San Francisco.
MAP was one of the earliest, but it didn't actually become an official organization. For the first 5 years, they did Captain Condom, who would go around the bars.
We have
and
a picture in the book.
Yeah.
Serious?
Captain Condom ended when, because it was an actual person, when it came out that Captain Condom liked to bareback. So that ended Captain Condom. Inconvenient truth. But so anyway, so there's that. But also kind of thinking about progress, right? The big kind of activist response was around non-compliant carrier legislation. So Minnesota passed a law that you could be incarcerated in a mental facility if you pass HIV to another person and were deemed a non-compliant carrier. The kind of gay community, that's still in the books today. The gay community had this huge outrage around it. But what the gay community never mentioned was that was only applied to prostitutes of color. So two prostitutes of color were actually the ones that both engendered the creation of this legislation at the same time that they were the ones who bore the brunt of this legislation. So kind of thinking about that progress. The other chapter in the book that deals with that has to do with both the University of Minnesota's drug Zygen, or Abacavir, which is one of the first-line drugs in HIV treatments, and kind of the politics of the University of Minnesota having a site license on that. I think at last measure, it's about to go off patent, but it earns the University of Minnesota, and I don't have this in front of me, at least right around $50 million a year. At the same time that you have literally millions of people dying, right? So how do we kind of think about a public university that is devoted to public knowledge and the betterment of the world at the same time that we're kind of profiting off death? And then the other half of that chapter talks about kind of accounting for new corporate participation within HIV AIDS services and funding, and kind of what do we buy and sell with that, right? Kind of accounting for the costs of normalcy in an epidemic that really isn't about normalcy, right? Like, HIV is not about normalcy. It's about, you know, like, it's about sex, it's about violence, it's about drugs, it's about, you know, power relations within sexual relations that are not equal, right? It's not kind of about normalcy. So talk about that. If you want to know more than that, you can read my dissertation eventually. that's the sequel.
Any other questions? Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.